KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in False Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
We've got music from every flavor, so keep it tuned on 91.9 on that FM dial where you can turn on, tune in, and jam out.
From KMXT in Kodiak, it's the Alaska Fisheries Report. I'm Terry Haynes.
The Alaska Fisheries Report is brought to you in part by the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, providing U.S. Coast Guard accepted hands-on safety training for all of Alaska's fishermen and their families. AMSEA at amse.org or 907-747-3287.
The Juneau Assembly voted to formally oppose an Alaska Board of Fisheries proposition that would limit Southeast Alaska hatchery production of pink and chum salmon by 25%. The proposition is intended to address the effects of hatchery salmon on wild salmon. Studies show that hatchery fish that return to other spawning areas may be competing for resources with wild fish. The Assembly's resolution says that more than half of Southeast Alaska's 2024 commercial harvest value came from hatcheries, and a reduction would negatively impact the region's economy. Assembly member Alicia Hughes Scandese objected, saying that she felt the city and borough of Juneau lacked the scientific expertise to weigh in on this issue, and that she would rather the Board of Fisheries use their knowledge to rule on the proposition.
I care about our wild stock tremendously, and I want to make sure fish are going to be here. And if there's any question that the hatchery fish are impacting wild fish and affecting genetic diversity, then I wouldn't want to jump in and say don't do that. I would want them to review the data and make an informed decision, which I can't do with this.
Douglas Island Pink and Chum, or DIPAC, Hatchery Executive Director Katie Harms attended the meeting to answer questions about the resolution. When asked about the impact of the Assembly not adopting it, Harms said the city would be out of alignment with other Southeast communities whose municipal governments already opposed the resolution.
And then if this proposal at the Board of Fish were to pass, it would lead to significant economic harm in the Juneau community. A 25% reduction in chum salmon production would lead to a likelihood of potential for the two seafood processors in town to be unable to operate year-round.
Harms said that a reduction in hatchery fish would impact DIPAC's future, and, quote, worst-case scenario, unquote, would be DIPAC closing. The Assembly passed the resolution 7-1 with Hugh Scandese opposing. Thanks to KTOO's Yvonne Crumry for that reporting.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, working to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. On the web at alaskaseafood.org.
Kodiak's commercial Tanner Crab fishery opened on Wednesday, January 15th at 12 noon. The Kodiak Crab Alliance Cooperative, which represents the local fleet, negotiated a different kind of deal this year. The cooperative is delivering between 70 and 80% of the total harvest to one processor that offered the best price. Usually, they negotiate with all of the processing companies at once for an acceptable price range, and different vessels deliver to different plants. This year, Alaska Pacific Seafood, which is owned by North Pacific Seafoods, will pay $5.75 per pound for the lion's share of the guidelined harvest, which is 770,000 pounds between Kodiak's East Side District and the South Side of the Alaska Peninsula. The rest of the crab can then be sold as part of the usual agreements between fishermen selling to their respective processors. That makes the Kodiak 2025 Tanner Crab fishery likely worth at least $3.1 million. The dockside price per pound is about $2 more than it was last year when fishermen harvested 3 million pounds. The crabs being harvested this year are the last part of a massive cohort that was first observed in 2018 and supported seasons since 2022. Fishermen expect the season to last about a week or less, depending on weather. There are 69 boats registered to fish Tanner Crab this season in Kodiak. Biologists with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game are unsure if there will be enough of a population for a season next year, but will make that decision after the summer trawl survey. Thank you to KMXT's Brian Venois for that report.
Statewide support of the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Satellite Technical Services, providing satellite communication solutions for commercial fishermen across the state of Alaska. Information and dealers can be found at satellitewest.com or by calling 206-321-6896.
More than 1 million pounds of Alaska's snow crab that might have previously gone unfished can now be processed thanks to an agreement between the cities of St. Paul and Unalaska. KUCB's Andy Lusk reports that the deal is a unique opportunity for collaboration and is expected to bring economic relief to St. Paul.
The Unalaska City Council unanimously approved a measure Friday that will allow snow crab, or Opelio, normally processed by Trident Seafoods in St. Paul, to come to Unalaska instead. The agreement comes after Trident's announcement that they would not process the crab at their facility on the Pribilof Island.
We had the situation with no processor in the northern region for snow crab.
That's Unalaska Fisheries Advisor Frank Kelty noting that without the St. Paul Trident plant, there's no processor to handle the portion of the harvest referred to as North Region snow crab. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game allotted harvesters a total catch of more than 4.5 million pounds this season. That gets split up among boats, processors, and communities through a quota-sharing system. This season, crabbers were set to deliver almost a third of that total catch to the North Region at St. Paul's Trident plant. But Trident pulled out, saying the amount was too low to justify opening the plant, which they've touted as the largest snow crab processing facility in the world. That left the crab with nowhere to go, and it would have otherwise been left in the ocean. That is, until Friday's special city council meeting. Here's Unalaska City Attorney Charles Cassiola.
Crab that would otherwise need to be landed in St. Paul could instead be landed and processed in Unalaska.
Unalaska City Council members voted to give the city of St. Paul its normal seafood tax for all of the North Region crab landed locally. St. Paul will also receive state fisheries business tax from the same catch.
The harvesters would pay St. Paul's 3.5% rather than Unalaska's 2% on crab that is North Region designated.
The agreement would net St. Paul the same fish tax revenue as if the crab were processed there. Still, the city says Unalaska should see a sales tax revenue bump and increased economic activity for the delivery and processing of the extra crab. The contract could provide significant economic relief to the Pribilof Island community, which has historically relied on crab as a major stream of revenue. St. Paul city officials have estimated that they're missing out on about $3 million in tax revenue due to the fishery closures. The city has lost more than two dozen employees in the last 3 years, and they've had to increase utility rates and take money from savings to stay afloat. The tax revenue from the small snow crab harvest could provide a much-needed bump to the community. Unalaska city officials say they're glad for the unique opportunity to help out the island's distant neighbor to the north. Kelty says Unicy and Westward, two Unalaska processors, can now take St. Paul's crab landings. The exemption agreement is active through the end of June. In Unalaska, co-reporting with Maggie Nelson, I'm Andy Lusk.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report is provided by the Stosh and Claudia Anderson Fund. In recognition of the fishing industry, which provides more than 50,000 Alaskan jobs from a renewable source.
Alaska red king crabs are more genetically diverse than previously thought, according to a new study. As KUCB's Sophia Stewart Rossi reports, the findings could be necessary for the crab's survival as ocean conditions change.
Scientists have thought that the genetic diversity of the Alaska red king crab fell into three groups. But now researchers are finding the species should be split into six, maybe even seven, genetically distinct groups based on more thorough DNA research. A new study in collaboration with universities and fishery organizations sequenced the whole genome of the crab across the state, which hasn't been done before. Scientists in the past only studied part of their genetic makeup. Knowing the whole genome of Alaska red king crab helps fishery managers understand more about the crab in specific regions and what they can do to help increase low populations by using regulation and possible stock enhancements tailored to a particular crab group. Decade-old research showed that Alaska red king crab comprised only three groups, one from the southeast region, one from the Gulf of Alaska and East Bering Sea regions, and one from the Aleutian Islands and Norton Sound regions. But new data shows the genetic diversity is even more specific than that. It notes genetic differences in the crabs in Bristol Bay, the Pribilof Islands, and maybe even between the Chukchi Sea and Norton Sound. So why are there so many different Alaska red king crab genetic groups throughout the state? Scientists say it's for a number of reasons, like natural selection and random genetic changes. But it also shows that the crabs have distinct genetic patterns for local adaptations, meaning they genetically adapt to their environment. And that's important. Scientists say having a wider range of genetic diversity can prevent a species from becoming extinct. But that doesn't automatically mean that the Alaska red king crab can handle major environmental changes like climate change. Some populations are still vulnerable, like the Gulf of Alaska group. The Gulf's commercial red king crab fishery has remained closed since the population collapsed in the early 1980s. Scientists say these newfound genetic signs of local adaptations in Alaska red king crab are crucial when studying how they'll adjust to warming oceans as human-caused climate change continues. It's not yet known what genetic differences might become important for the crab's survival in the future. In Unalaska, I'm Sophia Stewart Rossi.
Support for the Alaska Fisheries Report comes from Madsen, providing twice weekly service to Alaska's Emerald Isle.
Now, the rest of the story. It has been said, if Charles Lee had been born in Philadelphia rather than Chester, England, he might well have become Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army during the American Revolution. And from that position, one presumes, he might have become father of his country, our country. But enough of what might have been. Here's what happened. In early 1775, British troops, redcoats, were becoming a familiar sight in the city of Boston. To the colonists, it was an intolerable situation. So the First Continental Congress urged the colonies to strengthen their militias. That way, should Massachusetts be threatened by military aggression, she could count on the support of all America. Now, by this early stage of the mounting hostilities between the colonies and the motherland, the Continental Congress, still hoping for a peaceful solution, had just in case acquired an unofficial military advisor, a gentleman widely recognized among, quote, the greatest military characters of the present age, a retired British officer, Colonel Charles Lee. Colonel Lee of the 16th Dragoons, a veteran of numerous campaigns in his many lands, best known for his exploits commanding the 16th, a fierce, shrewd regiment of heavily armed cavalry. And one can imagine the delight of the Continental Congress upon learning that the same Colonel Charles Lee had adopted the cause of the American patriots. Congressmen were also impressed that Lee's wit and charm and intelligence indeed allowed him to discuss the philosophy of Jean Locke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau with the same ease that he might elaborate on military strategy. But most assuring of all was that he was the Lee of the 16th Dragoons. That made him the commander who had hammered that regiment, the 16th Dragoons, into a cunning, devastating fighting machine at which history would marvel. Colonel Lee had shown the 16th how to win all the time. And now the American colonists hoped that he would do the same for them. So before independence was declared, Charles Lee was commissioned a major general in the Continental Army. George Washington himself requested the appointment, and Lee inspired his fellow patriots with his brilliant military ideas. He gave his soldiers confidence in themselves and in their prospects against the British, and they believed in him too. After all, he was Charles Lee of the 16th Dragoons, the dread 16th Dragoons. And yes, General Lee did play a significant role in the Revolutionary War. Although his service was comparatively brief, there was no telling how far he might have gone. You see, in Portugal, he had taught his crack British regiment everything he knew about warfare. So they knew him very well. They knew him too well. And so on December 13, 1776, the almost invincible General Lee was outwitted. He was outwitted by his own magnificent monster, the one he had created, and caught off guard and conquered and captured in New Jersey by his own British 16th Dragoons. And now you know the rest of the story.
You're listening to Statewide News from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. The Biden administration has issued interim management instructions aimed at protecting subsistence resources in the Natural Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. It's not clear if anything in the guidelines from the Interior Department will survive the transition to the Trump administration. Acting Deputy Interior Secretary Laura Daniel Davis told reporters yesterday that the new measures stem from more than 80,000 public comments the department received about the reserve, which she referred to as the Western Arctic. Daniel Davis says no matter what happens next, it was the right thing to do.
We know we're in these seats for a few more days, and the next team may have a different perspective on how we manage public lands, including in the Western Arctic. But I think really we all have to agree that we must undertake activities in this incredible area with due consideration as to how they may impact subsistence resources that we are today identifying as a significant resource value.
The department is also proposing to expand the inventory of special areas in the reserve by about 3 million acres.
The National Petroleum Reserve is a tract of federal land as large as the state of Indiana and includes important habitat for migratory birds and wildlife. It also has substantial oil and gas potential. The Biden administration approved a major ConocoPhillips project there called Willow, but Senator Lisa Murkowski says it's burdened the reserve with too many restrictions, and she's counting the days until the department is in new hands. She had the opportunity yesterday to question the person nominated to be the next Secretary of Interior. Doug Burgum said at his confirmation hearing that he wants to be Alaska's partner in resource development.
I would view Alaska as one of the biggest assets this country has and one of the biggest responsibilities of Interior, and look forward to working with you.
That's exactly what I was hoping you would say.
Burgum is a former governor of North Dakota. The 2025 Kuskokwim 300 has been pushed back 2 weeks because of poor snowfall and looming above freezing temperatures, according to a release from the K300 Race Committee. The 300-mile race from Bethel upriver to Aniak and back will now start on Friday, February 7th. Race officials say that limited snowfall and unseasonably warm temperatures in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta throughout the winter have made it near impossible to check or mark trails. As of late Wednesday evening, no registered teams had dropped out of the race, despite the reschedule. A two-week delay for the K300 is not common. In its 46-year history, the race committee says it's been delayed several times due to extreme weather, usually for a day or two. And in 2021, the Kuskokwim 300 was delayed as part of COVID-19 mitigation plan. This is Alaska Public Media.
The Alaska Morning News is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. We're glad to have you tuning in, and we'd love to welcome you as a member. Make a donation to this station and be a part of the public media family. Thank you. Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
This is statewide news from Alaska Public Media. I'm Ava White. Human-caused climate change is making natural disasters like floods and landslides in Alaska more common and destructive. While property owners can purchase federal flood insurance, they might be out of luck if a landslide inundates their home. One Southeast Alaska lawmaker has proposed to offer a state flood insurance alternative that may include coverage for both floods and some landslides. KTOO's Claire Reese Larson reports.
Alaska State Senator Bert Stedman says the state needs to offer its own flood insurance alternative because the federal government's current policies are inadequate and expensive for many Alaskans.
They're getting ripped off by the federal government on flood insurance. They're getting an economic shotgun held to their head on how they can rebuild their properties. That's frankly unfair.
He proposed a bill that would create an Alaska Flood Authority to manage a state flood insurance fund. His aim is to provide more coverage at a lower cost to homeowners, as human-fueled climate change is making disasters like these a more frequent reality in Alaska. Stedman is a Republican who represents Southeast Alaska communities like Sitka and Wrangell that have experienced destructive or deadly landslides in recent years. So the bill's language includes mudflow as a type of flooding, which could mean certain landslides could fall under the proposed state coverage. His proposal comes after two large flood disasters last year in other parts of the state. Juneau experienced record-breaking flooding from a glacier outburst, and Lower Kuskokwim River communities faced historic breakup flooding, inundating homes and community services. Stedman says the Alaska-specific flood insurance policy would be a cheaper alternative to the federal program because it would be tailored to insure just the state's floods, not the nation's.
You know, we're pushed into this federal flood insurance program, but the rates that they charge are excessive.
Most standard home insurance policies don't cover flood damage. Flood coverage is typically a separate addition. Pretty much the only place you'll be able to find that type of coverage is through the NFIP, or the National Flood Insurance Program. The federal government offers its own flood coverage because private insurers have historically shied away from it. In some coastal communities in Alaska, homeowners are required to have the additional flood coverage. And Stedman says that can get really expensive.
You know, there's a lot of problems with the federal flood insurance program. The first order of the day is to get the subject matter in front of the legislators and start educating them so they understand the premium ripoff that our citizens have been paying for decades.
The bill's language says the authority wouldn't be allowed to charge a rate that is, quote, excessive, inadequate, or unfairly discriminatory. And the rates would be determined based on historical flood and damage data. There's no fiscal note on the bill yet, but Stedman estimates it could cost the state several million dollars in seed money. Emil Mackey is an insurance agent in Juneau, and he knows his way around what policies are available for residents in Southeast Alaska. He's excited about some aspects of the bill, but has doubts that the rates of a state program would actually be lower.
The National Flood Insurance Program is subsidized by the federal government. If we create this, the only way to do that is to also subsidize the program. And I just don't see the need.
But what he does see the need for is landslide insurance. The mudslide language in Stedman's bill is a start. Getting landslide insurance in the rainy and mountainous regions of Southeast Alaska is historically difficult. He chalks it up to the growing frequency of destructive landslides in the region and how that's changing the way insurers view risk.
Where the need is really for like landslide insurance, because we don't have any insurers in the state that do landslides, and I would like to see something like this.
Stedman says he hopes that landslides are a part of the discussion as the bill moves through the legislature, but they are not the main focus of the bill. The legislative session is set to begin next Tuesday. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
This is Alaska Public Media.
Aleutian Peninsula Broadcasting is generously supported by the City of Sandpoint. Sandpoint is a first-class city in the Aleutians East Borough, located on Humboldt Harbor on the northwestern Popoff Island. Anchorage is 575 nautical miles to the northeast. The Sandpoint City Council meets the second Tuesday of every month at 7 p.m. in the City Hall Council Chambers. Contact the City of Sandpoint by calling 907-383-2696, emailing sptcity@arctic.net, or visiting their website at sandpointak.com.
The Yunga Tribal Council is a proud sponsor of KSDP and Aleutian Peninsula Broadcasting. Thank you for your support.
This is KSDP Radio, broadcasting 8:30 a.m. Sandpoint, 88.1 FM on translator K201DA, King Cove, Alaska.
KSDP 8:30 a.m. Sandpoint, K201DA, King Cove, KFPS, False Pass.
Retirement a couple years ago, and had a pretty decent life until I got hurt and things changed dramatically. But yeah, so I know what the people who are sleeping on the city streets in tents right now are going through, because I've been there three times. And I'm not happy to say that it's a very good possibility it may happen again. I'm currently on the Section 8 wait list for a voucher. It'll probably take me another 10 years if I live that long. I mention that because of how huge the need is.
Can I say one quick thing? My last Section 8 tenant just moved, and that family was in this unit for 9 years. And I'm very happy that we were able to provide them with nice housing for all that time. But I swear, when that family moved out, I could hear the angels singing. I have another tenant I've had for over 20 years. The piece of paper that we have with our rental agreement is one side of one page. And for the Section 8 family that we housed, I have boxes and boxes and boxes of papers. It was insane. So, you know, maybe the reason that you can't find a Section 8 house, which I wish you could, is because the system makes it too hard for somebody like me to give it to you.
It is extremely stupid the way the Section 8 system is set up. Because now I know what a person like you, a smaller landlord, has to deal with. Well, hello, it's the same thing for us too. It was no fun for me to have to fill out a stack this big of paperwork just to get into this stupid place that I'm in right now. I was homeless at the time that I was going through all this. So I was walking around with a backpack with a whole heck of a lot of my belongings in. It weighed about 50 pounds. Not only did she want me to fill out a stack this thick of paperwork, but she also wanted this document. She also wanted that document. And I said, lady, I'm homeless. Me and the gentleman that I'm roommates with right now, we literally for about a whole week had to run all over San Francisco getting all these different documents and this, that, and the other, proof of this, proof of that. It was a pain in the rear end, and it needs to be streamlined. Wave a magic wand, build a heck of a lot more housing, and make sure that housing, once it's built, can be afforded by people who are poor.
If I could wave the magic wand, I would want the government to make renting housing less risky for small-time landlords. How can we provide housing that isn't crazy expensive? And one of the ways to do that is for somebody like Ed not to have to fill out a phone book worth of forms, and for me as the landlord not to have to fill out an entire document box of forms. There could be more eloquent solutions that we could all agree with and that would result in somebody having a better place to live, the landlord having a better experience, and the community being more at peace.
And that was Nancy Breyer and Ed Sanchez of San Francisco. That conversation was hosted by KQED's Ki Sung and Aaron Baldessari. This story is part of a partnership with Cortico, a nonprofit affiliated with MIT that uses AI to identify shared themes in conversations. Now, in keeping with NPR policy, AI played no role in the recording or the editing of what you just heard. We have more stories about people seeking common ground on tough issues at our website, hereandnow.org. And this afternoon, in All Things Considered,
live from NPR News in Boston, I'm Steve Brown. Israel's Security Cabinet has recommended approval of a ceasefire deal. The ceasefire would pause the 15-month war with Hamas in Gaza and release dozens of hostages held by militants there. The deal now goes to the full cabinet of ministers for final sign-off. It is expected to okay the ceasefire, which could start as soon as Sunday. Digital rights groups are slamming the Supreme Court over its unanimous decision to uphold the federal law banning TikTok beginning Sunday unless it is sold by its China-based parent company. The court ruled today the risk to national security posed by TikTok's ties to China overcomes concerns about limiting speech by the app or its 170 million users in the U.S. A sale does not appear imminent. The court's decision means new users won't be able to download the app or updates won't be available, but it won't disappear from users' phones. The Biden administration says popular weight loss drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy have been added to Medicare's list of medications that will be negotiated directly between the government and drug manufacturers. Price negotiations for the additional 15 drugs selected today will be handled by the incoming Trump administration and could result in billions of dollars in savings for taxpayers. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station, and from the Music Emporium, guitar sellers for more than 50 years, celebrating the enduring presence of music made on the front porch and center stage. You can learn more at themusicemporium.com. and WBUR presenting Beyond All Repair, a podcast about an unsolved murder, a family torn apart, and the woman who wasn't believed. Listen to Beyond All Repair wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Here and Now. Legendary broadcaster Bob Uecker died yesterday at the age of 90. He was known as Mr. Baseball and spent half a century in the booth calling games for the Milwaukee Brewers. Uecker started his career playing baseball. He was a big league catcher, but by his own admission, he wasn't very good. Here he is in 2003 accepting an award from Baseball's Hall of Fame as a broadcaster.
I still, and this is not sour grapes by any means, still think I should have gone in as a player.
There's the laughter in the crowd there. Let's bring in Todd Rosiak. He writes he covers the Brewers for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Todd, Bob Uecker, after 50 years, I'm sure was beloved in Milwaukee. How are you and the team taking the news?
It's been a blow. It's been a blow for everybody and anybody who grew up in the state, who grew up in the area, who follows the Brewers. Bob Uecker was just ubiquitous when it came to Milwaukee Brewer baseball and broadcasting the games. I wrote yesterday that he provided the soundtrack of my childhood, and I think there are thousands and thousands of people in this state and probably scattered around the country who can say the same thing. You know, those of us who grew up listening to the games on transistor radios, you know, those warm summer nights, playing with your friends outside in the garage while your dad's doing work, whatever the case may be. He really was the voice of summer. And, you know, if you talk about the pantheon of greats in the franchise, he's right up there at the top.
He's there, yeah. He starred in beer commercials. He was a regular guest on the Johnny Carson Show. There are statues of him at the stadium. Why did they call him Mr. Baseball?
That was just his self-deprecating humor that goes way back to his initial appearances on the Carson Show. You know, if you watch any of those and you see Johnny's reaction to, you know, him talking about his lifetime batting average and so forth, just his self-effacing, self-deprecating sense of humor. And it certainly latched on to him and carried along with him wherever he went for the rest of his life.
Yeah, speaking of his humor, you know, even if you weren't a Brewers fan, you might have known Uecker from his outlandish performance in the 1989 movie Major League, which was about this fictional Cleveland Indians baseball team. The players were terrible. Uecker played the team's play-by-play announcer. Here's a classic moment from that movie when Charlie Sheen's character throws a pitch that is wide of the strike zone by something like 20 feet.
Vaughn into the windup in his first offering. Just a bit outside. He tried the corner and missed.
I think about that every single time I see a wild pitch in baseball, like 35 years later. Was Bob Uecker really that funny in person outside the booth?
Funnier. And that's no lie. Funnier. Just incredible wit, incredibly fast. And you can see why he was so good on The Tonight Show and good in the roles that he filled. Kind of fun facts about Major League. I literally just hung up the phone from talking to Monty, who was his mute broadcast partner in the movie Major League. And I was in the stands as an extra when they filmed that in Milwaukee way back in 1988. So that movie is definitely near and dear to my heart.
Todd Rosiak covers the Brewers for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, remembering the legendary broadcaster Bob Uecker, who died at the age of 90 years old. Todd, thanks so much for joining us and doing this.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Hong Kong grew up admiring her father's dedication to the craft.
When I was a child, I always woke up by the sound of the typewriter every day, even in the weekends.
The Nobel Prize winner on her haunting new novel, We Do Not Part. Plus the latest news from L.A. to the Middle East, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and from Rhodes Scholar, celebrating 50 years of transformative learning adventures for adults in over 100 countries. Learn more at rhodesscholar.org/explore. And WBUR presenting the Internet Culture Podcast, Endless Thread. Feed your curiosity with untold histories, unsolved mysteries, and stories about technology, memes, and madness. Endless Thread. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now. A lot of people are feeling pretty cynical, hopeless about American politics. Well, our next guest says one way to counteract all this is to become more engaged, more politically and civically active. Sam Daly Harris is founder of the anti-poverty organization Results, and he's author of the book Reclaiming Our Democracy, and the latest edition is out this week in paperback. In the book, he lays out how citizens can talk to elected officials, influence policy, and work for real change on issues they care about. And Sam Daly Harris joins us. Sam, welcome back to Here and Now.
Great to be here.
So your book, Your Career, are about the argument that individuals have political power. Individuals can make change with in-person advocacy, say going, meeting lawmakers face-to-face. And I guess I have to ask in this moment, is this a tough time for this argument? We are mired, you know this, in the politics of grievance and corporate money swamping American politics.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of quotes that inspire me and I think give some instruction. Apollo astronaut said, "We aren't passengers on spaceship Earth, we're the crew." Well, are we? And if we are, how does crew operate? And futurist Alex Steffen said, "In fact, these days, cynicism is obedience." Well, yeah, if I'm cynical, I'm obedient to the way things are. Well, I'm not going to do anything about it. Why would I, if nothing I do makes a difference? But I think both of those quotes are cues to why we do need to be involved.
Yeah. I mean, I guess some might say, well, it's not exactly cynicism of the moment. This is kind of the realism of the moment.
Yeah, that's right. Martin Luther King gave this amazing speech decades ago to the American Bar Association, where he said, it's not only the actions and words of those of ill will, but it's the inaction and silence of those of goodwill. And so we need to see if we're in the inaction category or we're finding ways to get involved.
Yeah. Well, Sam, the heart of your argument is about what you call transformational advocacy. Briefly, what does that mean? Like, how do people do it?
Sure. Well, first of all, everybody knows transactional advocacy, sign the petition, transaction complete. But with transformational advocacy, you're trained, encouraged, and succeed at doing things as an advocate you never thought you could do, like meet with a member of Congress and bring them on board to your issue. And when you do those things, you see yourself in a new light. A transformation in how you see yourself takes place. And then the trick is finding organizations that work to deliver transformational advocacy, not just online petitions.
And in your book lays out a lot of this, a lot of examples of individuals who have done this, who are doing this. What is the best evidence, the best example that this work has brought real change?
Okay, well, let me give you one. From 2019, President Trump's first term, he called for a 29% cut to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria after the Global Fund had saved 38 million lives since its inception. Now, most people never knew that he called for a 29% cut, and if they did, they'd probably throw up their hands. What can you do? You can't fight City Hall. The folks I know in Results, for example, they rolled up their sleeves, got to work. They got hundreds of members of Congress to co-sponsor resolutions in the House and Senate and to sign letters to the Secretary of the State at the time and the top appropriators. And in the end, Congress approved and the president signed into law a 16% increase to the Global Fund instead of the 29% cut. And by 2022, the Global Fund partnership had saved 59 million lives since its inception in 2002. When do we hear about 59 million lives saved? I mean, we really usually hear the other side of the coin.
Yeah. Boy, as you talk about that, I'm thinking about the country, you know, just recently saying goodbye to President Jimmy Carter. And some of the issues he and the Carter Center chose to pursue were not kind of top-line polemical in the headlines issues, but eradicating the guinea worm, right, in the developing world, building homes in places most Americans don't go, less partisan issues. Yeah. Is that a useful strategy for you?
Well, I mean, the strategy of finding something you want to get done, whether it's on climate or whether it's on poverty or whether it's on peace issues or gun violence or whatever, working for positive change is a great strategy as an organization or as an activist. If I could just say one other thing about Jimmy Carter, it was his Presidential Commission on World Hunger that called for the political will to end hunger. And I was inspired in working at that time. This is the late 70s. And I ended up asking 7,000 high school students what the name of their member of Congress was, and fewer than 3% could answer correctly. And I started this anti-poverty lobby results out of that gap between Carter's commission call for the political will and the lack of basic information of who represented us in Washington. Those students happen to be in their 60s now, but that was a long time ago. But
yeah, well, I mean, over this time, you and your organization have worked a lot on issues including poverty, gone up to Congress to meet with lawmakers. And I guess I want to ask you, what is the most striking conversation you have had face-to-face with a lawmaker, member of Congress, who you disagree with?
What's striking for me is the conversation that the volunteers have. Let me give you, go back to the story about the increase to the Global Fund. When I do my presentations, I have this slide, and it's a photo of Margaret Smith. Now, I always say an amazing woman she is, but she's holding Senator Ted Cruz's hands with two hands. And she said to me, I learned in results that I hold Senator Cruz's hands with two hands and I don't let go until I finish my laser talk on the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And that was the first year Senator Cruz said yes to any of their requests and co-sponsoring the Senate resolution supporting the Global Fund that President Trump had called for a big cut to.
Sam, allow me to challenge the premise for a moment here. You know, I just spoke to a whistleblower, a scientist inside the EPA. He's gone public to talk about what's happened in his case. He helps the agency decide whether to let new chemicals on the market, whether they're safe enough. And he has documentation of chemical companies who go on the inside and challenge the science questions that he raises. He has had bosses in the government modify and delete his writings in favor of industry. Just one example, this is public. When these powerful actors, industries, have access to the back door of government, how can you compete by knocking on the front door?
Well, you can't compete if you're silent. You can't compete if you stay on the couch and don't do anything.
I mean, there's a loudness, right? I mean, you're talking about kind of speaking, but the way the system works now allows a kind of volume from certain actors that is multiples of other actors.
Yes, absolutely. But the point is, it is multiples. It's many multiples, but not if citizens were actually engaged. I mean, after the election, Liz Cheney said, Americans must be the guardrails for democracy. Well, we need to do that. And part of the reason we will or we won't is our cynicism.
How, in your view, does activism change the people who do it?
Well, I'll tell you the story of a woman. She's on staff now. She was a volunteer. Her name is Ellie Sparks. She said, when I started with the group Citizens Climate Lobby, I was suffering from climate trauma. But after she got engaged and she got trained, She spent 4 days meeting with 20 congressional offices, and at the end she called the experience sacred and profound. And that's available to us, you know, if we open ourselves up to it and if we find an organization that works to deliver transformational advocacy.
That's Sam Daly Harris, an activist and author of the book Reclaiming Our Democracy. The latest edition is now out in paperback. Sam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And you can find an excerpt of the book and a link to find information about organizations doing what Sam calls transformational advocacy at our website, hereandnow.org.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and MathWorks, creator of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. And BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere. At betterhelp.com/public.
It's Here and Now. Superheroes once dominated the box office, and Hollywood is banking that they'll make a comeback in 2025.
Home. David, home.
It's not entirely unpleasant seeing you again.
You may be Captain America, but you're not Steve Rogers.
You're right.
I'm not.
New Spider-Man and Daredevil shows are coming soon to TV. Then there's a new Captain America movie starring Anthony Mackie. And this summer, a Superman film will reboot the entire DC cinematic universe. And you know who is excited about this? NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, come on in. I know you love a good superhero story, don't you?
Harrison Ford as the Red Hulk? Come on, man.
Well, clearly you're a fan.
What I love about being excited about this is that I know my good friend and colleague Bob Mondello, the film critic for NPR, is going to hate it. This is awesome.
Well, but why is there this sudden surge of superhero content across TV and the big screen?
Well, I think it feels sudden to us because we look at the schedule and we suddenly realize that there are all these things set up. You mentioned the Captain America movie. You mentioned Daredevil on Disney Plus. There's a Fantastic Four movie. There's a movie called The Thunderbolts. And, of course, we have the big Superman movie that will mark the reinvention of the DC cinematic universe under the aegis of director James Gunn. And I think what has basically happened is that Hollywood was going to try and make 2025 the year that we got back to the core business of Hollywood. We got back to more traditional kinds of films, more traditional kinds of TV shows. And TV, we've also seen more medical dramas and westerns and cop dramas. And maybe there's a sense that after the disruption of the strikes, that maybe this would be the year that we sort of get back to the things that people know Hollywood for. And, you know, even though some people are really frustrated by how many superhero projects there are out there, they have made a lot of money.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of these shows. This week, we got the trailer for Daredevil Born Again. Let's listen.
I was raised to believe in grace. But I was also raised to believe in retribution.
right. Mm-hmm. That was Disney Plus, as you mentioned, a sequel to the show that Netflix canceled in 2018. But this has the same actors. Why is Disney bringing this back?
Well, you know, Netflix didn't just cancel Daredevil. There was a whole sort of universe built around that. The shows Jessica Jones and Luke Cage and Iron Fist. And basically Netflix's agreement with Marvel to make these TV shows, they decided to end it. And so all of those shows are now on Disney Plus. Also, these characters, I think, are very popular. Mm. There was some sense that the storytelling in a lot of the series on Netflix didn't work so well. So now they have a chance to reboot a lot of this. And so we're going to see all these characters brought over from these series that were developed for Netflix, played by the actors who played them there. And hopefully, you know, Marvel's going to get a shot to show what it can really do with these characters, free from that agreement that they had with Netflix.
Yeah, so that's TV, but next month we're going to start getting some movies too, including Captain America, Brave New World. This is starring Anthony Mackie, as I said, as Sam Wilson, the first black Captain America. So tell us more about that one.
So people who watched the Disney Plus series, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, saw that Anthony Mackie's Falcon character, Sam Wilson, stepped up to be the new Captain America. And what's interesting is that the comics have always used Captain America as a way to show the struggle between what America aspires to be and what it actually is sometimes. So when you make that character black, that dynamic gets even bigger, because that's the role that black folks have often had in America. So I can't wait to see what they do, both with these themes and with the new cast that they have.
Yeah, and then what about this huge event this summer? Superman comes out. We said it's going to reboot the entire DC extended universe. What does that mean exactly? Because I have a feeling people are going to get really stoked about this one.
Well, you know, I think there was always a sense that the DC had a bunch of great characters in Superman and Batman and Green Lantern that for some reason they could not figure out how to make movies that were successful. So now we have a director who's come along. He's taken control of all of the products that are connected to these superheroes. And the first sort of real test of his new vision is going to be the Superman movie that James Gunn wrote and directed. And then this is the guy who, you know, brought Guardians of the Galaxy to Marvel and made, you know, created movies that were hugely successful there. He did a version of the Suicide Squad, and he did a TV show called Peacemaker set in that Suicide Squad kind of universe that was also successful. So there's a sense that if anybody can figure out how to take these classic characters and reinvent them for the modern age, it's James Gunn. Yeah. My hunch is that the Superman movie in particular is going to do well, and people who, you know, don't like these films are going to have to tolerate them for a while longer.
All right, Eric, put your cape on, buckle your seatbelt. I think you're in for a ride here.
get your bat wings ready, as they might say in the old TV show.
All right, NPR TV critic Eric Duggins, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Museum of Science in Boston, dedicated to inspiring a lifelong love of science in everyone, in museums, classrooms, and online, offering engineering design challenges, digital experiences, live presentations, and more. MOS.org.
I'm Scott Tong.
We are transferring power from Washington, D.C., and giving it back to you, the people.
President Trump's first administration promised a safer America, a border wall paid by Mexico, and goodbye Obamacare. Not all that happened. Trump's second inauguration, next time on Here and Now.